the world economy, the U.S. economy, possible consequences of Obama's outreach to Muslims, the political situation in Iran. We've got potential, well, a nightmare, potentially, Afghanistan, Pakistan. We've even got Russia, very, very troubling information on Russia. We've got the moral agenda in America. The chance of another $1 trillion stimulus plan, Israel peace efforts with Russia and the EU applying pressure, Israel's new government, a lot of Middle East-related issues. But I want to start on the home front particularly because there's just endless issues to talk about as it concerns the issues right here in our great country. I'll say right up front here that I want to bring on the familiar voice here of Bill Koenig. He represents Koenig's International News. That's watch.org on the web. And we'll say more about some of his products and contact information. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Good morning, Jan.
Well, you heard my around the world in 120 minutes. Can we do it?
Yeah. Well, we got a lot to cover for sure.
Yeah. Now, listen, some people may not be familiar. I have new listeners all the time that I hear from, and they may not be real familiar with what you're doing. And let me just say that Bill is a White House correspondent, and he's one of about a half a dozen who are Christian White House correspondents in there with the very secular press corps. And, Bill, how long have you been doing this?
8 years, Jan, going on my ninth.
Ninth year. So you've covered a couple of administrations?
That's correct. I came to Washington right after President Bush was elected, and now starting on this administration.
All right. You have had very likely been in on the press conferences recent days and weeks, including perhaps the one yesterday. But just give us an overview. Has anything changed for you in the new administration with you representing Koenig's International News there in Washington?
No, Jan, everything is pretty much the same. Every time you have a new administration, you have a tremendous amount of people that start covering the White House, and the briefing room overflows, and, there's people everywhere, and it's difficult to get any questions answered. They pretty much spread it around the room unless you're a major network. So, we're almost six weeks into this. So actually more than that now, 56 days. So, about 8 weeks. So what's interesting now is, it's getting back to more normal. There's rooms and seats to sit in the briefing room. More of the real serious covers of the White House are now in place. So I think that's positive from that perspective, where we'll be able to focus in on some issues that are important.
Well, you say, and we will promote your Koenig's Eye View from the White House, the weekly e-newsletter, but you say this is last week's e-newsletter. You say about earth-shaking and enormous events this year. Just let me read the paragraph you wrote here, and then please expound on it if you would. But you say, I sincerely believe that due to the actions of overly aggressive members in Obama's administration that are pushing the abortion stem cell agenda, the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender agenda, attempting closer ties and making peace with Islam at the expense of Israel and our relations with the UK, our nation's Middle East objectives, acquiescing to Russia's demands and pressuring Israel to make peace with the Syrians and the Palestinians while putting their survival in jeopardy, will lead to earth-shaking and enormous events this year. Why don't you take it from there, Bill?
Well, Jan, you started off with the hard one right off. I mean, not a hard one, but the very impactful and very significant one right off the bat. I call it Obama's perfect storm.
Yeah.
In Eye to Eye, my book, I concentrated on the consequences of Bush, Clinton, and Bush when we applied pressure on Israel and the enormous record-setting catastrophic events that happened immediately after the presidents, those presidents or their secretaries of state, applied pressure on Israel to divide their covenant land. And President Bush was right on abortion. I mean, he was pro-life totally. He was right on marriage, but he attempted to divide the covenant land, even though being a friend of Israel, that land's not to be tampered with. And he paid enormous political price, and as well as our nation paid an enormous price, because of attempting to divide that land and creating a Palestinian state. My point in what you just read there, Jan, is the fact that this administration is going to hit the big three, it looks like. You've got members of the Obama administration that are determined to force this no limitations and when it comes to sexual orientation and no discrimination. 12:01 p.m.
That's right.
Within a minute of, at the time, let me put it this way, at the time Obama was being inaugurated, the most far-reaching agenda that we've ever seen placed at the White House and on their website had to do with civil rights, and it was a focus on same-sex relationships, sexual orientation, and they even had a category. If you go to the White House website, whitehouse.gov, and click on agenda at the top, and then the first one is civil rights, and click on that, you won't believe what you're going to read. And part of that was the LGBT agenda,
right,
which has to do with lesbians,
yep,
gays, bisexuals,
you.
And transgender.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so hard for anybody to even comprehend it without looking at it.
Mm-hmm. All right, but, you know, we also discussed that the Lord allowed Obama to have a rather flawless campaign.
Absolutely.
Two-year campaign. It seemed... you know, I'm going to stop short of saying God paved the way for him, but, I mean, he had very little opposition. It seemed everything went right. I'm sure things behind the scenes were going wrong all the time, but that's not the point. Is it seemed pretty flawless. So he overcame so much. And like you say, the Bush administration, President Bush, had a lot of people committed to praying for him on a daily basis. And, you know, sadly, I think that that's not quite the case with President Obama. I run into people all the time who just say, I just can't pray for this guy. And I think that's kind of a sad situation. But a lot of people are saying that.
Well, I think what's very, very important here, Jan, along that line, the three key areas are the land of Israel, anything to do with the seed, or with life, and also with a immoral agenda, any one of those three areas, when our administration or the Supreme Court crosses the line on those things, major catastrophic events happen. So we have the perfect storm of Israel, this grievous pro-abortion position, and this LGBT agenda that is on the White House website. And I believe that the people that are promoting abortion and this LGBT agenda are so committed,
mm-hmm,
that I'm seeing personally that they are going to push and force this through as soon as possible, possibly even this year. And that does not bode well for our country. Along the lines of, you made a great point. I mean, Obama basically had a two-year flawless campaign. There was a couple bumps with Reverend Wright and then when Palin was selected. But other than that, it went so smoothly. And a big part of that is 9 out of 10 journalists that cover the White House,
mm-hmm,
and cover politics are liberal. And they favor the left. So a lot of things that would disqualify any other candidate, especially a Republican candidate, was never allowed to surface, except for some conservative media sources like Fox News or World Net Daily or somebody like that, or what we do. So
okay,
it didn't surface, Jen. This is also interesting, too, because at one time I felt that McCain would be great for Israel security, great for U.S. security, and that would probably enhance his chance. As a matter of fact, even around September, it looked like he pretty much had it, he was starting to move ahead. Palin created excitement, and then this major economic crisis happened, and it affected things. But the key here, Rabbi Daniel Lappin told some friends of mine, as well as Lance Lambert, specifically, when I told him, I talked to him about McCain and Israel and the U.S., they go, no. The next president is going to be Obama because he is the perfect president for the moral times or immoral times that we're living in. And they were both absolutely convinced that he would be the next president because of the condition of the nature of our country.
Well,
and I think that's part of the reason the Lord's allowed this.
Well, Bill, there's another item here that we haven't talked about, and that is apparently the president may overturn the Defense of Marriage Act. And DOMA was passed by Congress back in 1996 and basically says that the federal government is not to treat same-sex relationships as marriages for any purpose, even if concluded or recognized by one of the states. And that was passed pretty heavily Well, the Defense of Marriage Act was passed pretty heavily, 85 to 14 in the Congress and Senate, 342 to 67. And now this administration may overturn all that?
Absolutely. If you look at that agenda under civil rights, that's all addressed, Jan, every bit of that. And they're going to give civil unions so many rights and benefits, including benefits for federal workers, that it's, yeah, it's going to be called civil unions, but basically you'll have all the rights of marriage. And all the details, Jan, are right there in the WhiteHouse.gov website under agenda, under civil rights. And that's exactly what their plan is. I was at the White House the other day. Actually, it was late last week, and Ed Chen with Bloomberg asked the White House when they were going to move forward with allowing benefits for federal workers, same-sex benefits, and that were they moving forward with the defeat of the Defense of Marriage Act, and they said we are going to move forward as Obama said during his campaign. So that's coming.
Bill, can I this is Heidi, and I just wanted to pop in here and mention that when I read your newsletter last night, the one thing that popped out to me about this particular subject is that President Clinton actually signed the Defense of Marriage Act. So to me, it shows an extreme difference between those two administrations, both Democratic administrations.
Absolutely, Heidi. When Jan just mentioned, the votes were overwhelmingly in favor of the Defense of Marriage. It was like, I think it was 83-16 in the Senate, and the House was almost the same percentage. And, you know, here we have a new administration that's completely diametrically opposed to that and does not favor that. And also, unfortunately, with Pelosi and Reid there in Congress and the moral condition of the Democratic Party, I think we'll see this thing reversed and a change. It's hard to believe. That was 1996. I mean, here we are 12, 13 years later, and what an incredible change in attitude.
Bill, when we talked the other day, you were mentioning Rahm Emanuel, who's chief of staff. And, by the way, I think your intention is to perhaps somehow befriend him or at least get more acquainted with him than you have with some of the people in the various administrations, particularly the Bush administration. You even want to give him one of your books, Eye to Eye, Facing the Consequences of Dividing Israel. And, folks, that is the book you can find at Bill's website, watch.org. You can also sign up for his weekly e-newsletter, KNX iView from the White House. Help the audience understand a little bit better Rahm Emanuel. There are people who say this is the best thing that could have happened as it concerns the chief of staff, and others are saying, well, Obama's over him, so how much is he, for instance, could he be pro-Israel? His father fought in the Jewish underground in Israel in the mid-40s against the British, fought with the Irgun. How do you perceive Emanuel governing, helping to govern?
Well, it's an interesting one, Jan, because, as you said, his father was part of Irgun. He has deep, deep, deep roots. Irgun was part of, Menachem Begin was part of that. Rahm Emanuel's father was part of that. A lot of the way these heroes helped lead Israel to the point that they became a nation, these are some of Israel's original heroes. His dad was born in Jerusalem. They moved to the United States, and his dad's a medical doctor in Chicago, a very well-respected man and obviously very pro-Israel. Rahm has volunteered for the Israeli Defense Force, working at bases during Desert Storm and some other skirmishes. He's very, you know, I understand he goes at least once a year to Israel in the summertime. He has a heart for Israel. And I did some study on Rahm and his background because, you know, he's a political pit bulldog. The Republicans don't like working with him, and he rubs people wrong. But what's interesting here, Jan, is he choreographed the handshake between Rabin and Arafat when he served in the Clinton administration. He was very hopeful that there would be a time where Israel would live in peace and security. But 24 months ago, he said, I don't see under the circumstances with Hamas and even with Hezbollah on the northern border the possibility of a peaceful Palestinian state or the possibility of peace for Israel seems remote. And I think where he's moved from a hopeful position to a more pragmatic position, and I believe that that is definitely the way he believes now, that it just peace just doesn't seem practical, especially with Hamas controlling the Palestinian Authority. So based on that, I am favorable. I mean, I favor the fact that he's moving in the right direction, and you just can't get away from the deep roots that his family has to the nation of Israel, as well as his mother being the first flight attendant hired by El Al Airlines. So he's got great connection to Israel, and I think he's going to be an important component going forward.
All right. I want to transition into the economy, actually the world economy. But let's focus first on, let's put an extra spotlight on the American economy, because all sorts of stories, and you know it very well, are popping up about, first of all, a global alternative to the U.S. dollar. And apparently in this upcoming G20 meeting in London, the International Monetary Fund, with the support of the U.S. and Russia, seem to be poised to launch a one-world currency at that particular meeting. We're reading more and more about it. Joel Rosenberg sent out an e-alert this week, and he said that the United Nations panel says that the world should ditch the dollar. World leaders are discussing a move to a single currency. And let's see, the story comes out of the Moscow Times, reported that Russian leaders that are coming to the G20, world leaders in London, it's just in a few weeks, and the leaders of various other nations, such as Libya and Iran, have begun speaking about creating single currencies. Some are saying that would be the euro. What is your take on that?
Well, there's been conversation for about the last couple years about another major currency that would be something that would counter the dollar. Some people thought it would be the euro. Then there was a conversation that Iran was going to try to develop a group of countries that would buy and sell oil using the euro or another currency. There is we're the reserve currency. We're the major currency in the world right now. China holds a lot of dollars. Other countries hold a lot of dollars, and the dollar has had its ups and it's had its downs, and now it's had its ups, and now it starts to move down again. And there's a concern if the Federal Reserve continues to put all these dollars into the market, then the dollar is going to continue to get weaker and weaker and weaker because of the printing practices of the Federal Reserve. I think that what these other nations are talking about is a more stable currency that they can be part of. Because, you know, some of these countries have just been hammered holding dollars. I mean, when you look at the conversion right now, the dollar and the yen, I mean, it's like, I think, 96, 98 yen to a dollar, where it used to be 130, 140. That affects their exports. Same thing with the euro. It was up to 156. It was $1.56 per euro. Now it's down about 1.28. So there's a lot of fluctuation, and this affects businesses throughout the world in terms of their exports and imports and also our economy. So basically what they're trying to do here is looking for more currency stability, which will lead to more economic stability. And a lot of people don't realize this right now is, yes, we're going through a challenging time economically in our country, but most nations of the world are in much worse shape than us. And we have caught the Hong Kong flu, and the world is catching the pneumonia.
Yeah.
And we are being blamed for it, rightly so, and they are looking for more fiscal and financial security, and they believe a move to a eventual one-world currency, which is very biblical, is going to be the solution.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think the question is, would there be an intermediary first come, another one-world currency, and then the leap to cashless society? We don't know that, but, I mean, it's interesting to speculate upon.
Yeah, and I think that's what's going to happen, Jan. It won't jump. I mean, we have less major currencies now. We used to have a lot more currencies in Europe. But now we have the euro that's predominant and the British pound, and then we have the yen, and then we have the dollar. I mean, those are really pretty much the four major currencies of the world. And obviously other countries have their own currencies, but as far as big, strong, dominant currencies, you could see it go from four to maybe two and eventually one, something of that nature. And with the practices of the central banks around the world that are pumping out a lot of money in order to stabilize their economies, like the UK, like the United States, and other countries are considering the same thing, it's going to create monetary instability. And, again, it will lead to eventually a couple currencies and eventually to one currency.
Now, as David Limbaugh has written in a number of articles, it seems to be to me that the administration has, and he states it very well, a war on the American dream. And Limbaugh says that the president has bought class warfare to levels that would make Marxists blush. Now, I'm a little concerned because I heard a clip. I actually was watching Hal Lindsey's program a week ago. And, folks, if you don't agree with his eschatology, we happen to. But just set that aside because the clip I want to play has nothing to do with eschatology. It has everything to do with what's happening in our country right now as it concerns, well, management by crisis is what Hal calls it. And just to summarize, basically, Hal says that this management by crisis is you create a problem or a conflict and exaggerate it. You publicize and create opposition to it. You offer a solution, simple the better. It doesn't have to be logical. Appeal to the emotions and make the public believe something is being done for them. And he brings out that this is from George Hegel. And then students of Karl Marx call it, they followed up and called it the management by crisis, which actually is the centerpiece of communism. And let me just play, it's about 4 minutes here, and let you hear what he has to say.
Broken down into its component steps, here's how Hegel's principle works. Step one, create a problem or conflict. Practitioners will either identify a potential problem or create one out of thin air, then exaggerate it beyond its actual importance. While nobody doubts that the economy is in trouble, on election day, the Dow Jones was still above 9,000. Since then, even former President Bill Clinton has called on President Obama to stop talking down the economy. Step two, publicize the problem and create opposition to it. The left in America has a tailor-made apparatus for publicizing the problem and creating opposition among the population, the mainstream media. By constantly covering the problem from the administration's desired slant, the media makes the conflict a foregone conclusion. Eventually, the public begins to clamor for a solution to this problem. The steady drumbeat from the White House is, "We inherited this problem from the high-spending, low-tax Bush administration. The only way to fix it is to increase spending tenfold and raise taxes." In reality, the stimulus bill stimulates nothing but more government spending. It's not stimulating the economy. President Obama has proposed spending more money in the first 6 weeks of his term than President Bush spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the general war on terror, and Hurricane Katrina over a period of 7 years. According to the Office of Management and Budget, the Bush deficit for 2008 was a comparatively paltry $410 billion. The current administration is now projecting an annual deficit well over $1 trillion in the near future. Obama has committed to more deficit spending than any nation in the history of the world. Over the next 3 years, the government will need to borrow $3.6 trillion. But very few dare to question or oppose anything because of the crisis. Step three, offer a solution. Of course, in today's America, with its soundbite mentality, the simpler the solution, the better. And there's no need for it to be logical. The best ones are those that appeal to the emotions and make the public feel that something really good is being done for them, when in reality, something really bad is being done to them, especially when it's a solution no one knew we needed before the conditioning process of the step two. And when you're talking numbers like these, no one can actually comprehend their magnitude. It's like we've entered a surreal world. Solving the current crisis would rob the administration of its greatest asset. The Democrats have been pushing universal health care since 1993, but it has always been wisely rejected because it would be too expensive. Further, as much as we want it to be, government-controlled universal health care doesn't work. Just ask the British or the Canadians. But thanks to the media-magnified worst economic crisis since the 1930s, universal health care was sneaked into the stimulus bill without even a debate. Our current hyped-up crisis has also allowed billions for environmental spending, billions more for trade unions, cap-and-trade schemes, and the list goes on ad nauseum. Most of these long-term favorite liberal projects have nothing to do with stimulating the economy. It's self-serving pork by any other name. 20 years ago, no politician in America would dare to confess the use of Hegelian tactics to manipulate public opinion. They'd employ them without hesitation, but they would never admit it. But last week in Brussels, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton echoed Rahm Emanuel. She told the European Parliament,
"Never waste a good crisis. And when it comes to the economic crisis, don't waste it when it can have a very positive impact on climate change and energy security, and that's what we're trying to do."
Hegel couldn't have said it better. To Obama's cabinet, a financial crisis is not for solving. It's for manipulating to achieve a desired goal. So the average guy gets hurt a little. He'll get over it. After all, the proletariat feels it must be for its own good.
Management by crisis, the philosophy that comes from George Hegel, and then students of Karl Marx picked up on it and called it management by crisis, gave it sort of the term, and it became the centerpiece of communism. So what do we make of this?
Well, I think that Hal did an excellent job of deciphering that and then also articulated it to the point of giving it for us to understand today, just the parallels to what Hegel preached and taught to what is happening today. We can go back to September of last year when Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, and President Bush and the Fed Chairman Bernanke said that we have got to do something now. We can't put this off any longer. They passed a $700 billion stimulus plan to make sure the U.S. financial system didn't melt down. And as we've seen even this week, a lot of that stimulus, the $170 billion that went to AIG, went to them, and it went to Goldman Sachs. Paulson's former firm received $13 billion. Major U.S. banks, Chase, Bank of America, and many others. So this bailout basically was helping AIG not default on these massive amount of credit default losses that they had, that they were obligated to pay to U.S. banks, Wall Street firms, and foreign banks. So we are basically picking up the tab, mm-hmm. the American taxpayer, mm-hmm. for this casino mentality on Wall Street and for the risky and precarious lending of our U.S. banks. But what happened here is they created and exaggerated this chaos. Obviously, it was extremely important. But, you know, it would better, and there was a lot of Republicans and conservatives said, let them fail. Let them go into bankruptcy. Let them
That's
fail.
Right.
Let's cleanse and purge the system
That's
and
right.
let's start from scratch. Instead, Jan, we have $700 billion of additional obligations for all of us to pay, and that's just the beginning.
Well, as we speak, Bill, $2 trillion are being printed, apparently by the Federal Reserve. $2 trillion being printed.
That's actually now, as of this week, Janet, it's going to be up to $3.2 trillion. They're adding $1.2 trillion to that level.
That's money being printed.
That's correct. They're going to make that available. It was $700 billion in September. Now it's it was $2 trillion, and then as of last week, it's $3.2 trillion, and they won't tell people where the $2 trillion went.
Okay. All right. Let's move on in the interest of time, because we need to get to some other parts of the world. But I'm not through with this economic issue, too. And Heidi, you want to weigh in with anything, please feel free to do so. But let's here's the bottom line issue or question in all of this. And we're talking about management by crisis. I think one of the issues is the administration, I mean, they seem to, I don't want to say care less, because that wouldn't be fair, but they seem to not take a real serious interest in what's happening. And the president makes some remarks that are just a little bit strange to understand, because they seem to be, these remarks seem to be a little bit apathetic. And it almost begs the question, is this lack of perception, is this because he thinks maybe that what's happening will serve his ultimate purpose?
Yeah, I think you're right, Jan. I really sense that the last couple of weeks. I go, you know, I've been around a lot of stressful environments when I was in business myself back during the 80s and 90s in commercial real estate. And I've been around a lot of stressful situations that President Bush faced with 9/11, Katrina, and other major things that he had to face with, as well as the financial tumble right before he left office. And I was around those guys, and I know how serious those guys took things. Mm-hmm. And you could see it in their face, you could hear it in their words, in their press conferences, or in the words of their press secretaries. And I literally, and you made a great point there, very discerning, that over the last couple of weeks, I haven't really felt a lot of this stress. I know he's the new president's very laid back and pretty calm and casual, but I just didn't sense the tension and stress. You certainly didn't see it on his program with Jay Leno the other night, in one of the worst weeks we've had in U.S. financial history. And I certainly didn't hear it in the voice of his press secretary the last couple of days. I did kind of feel his press secretary is pretty exhausted, because I think he understands the reality, what's happening, what's coming. But nonetheless, I didn't feel this need to do something quickly. But then again, it plays, and like you said, this could very well play into their agenda.
Yeah.
My great concern, Jan, is the fact that we've slapped $700 billion stimulus plan. We've got another $750 or $60 billion stimulus plan. We have a $700 billion TARP plan. We have a $3.6 trillion budget that's about to be discussed. Yesterday, OMB came out and said actually Obama's deficit and addition to our federal debt is more like $9.5 trillion over the next 10 years. They use 10 years, not 8 years, but
we can't
the numbers
wrap our minds
are much
around
higher
it
than expected. And if they're higher now, you know they're going to be much, much higher. So the bottom line here, Jan, is what we're doing is we're strapping a tremendous amount of debt on our country that needs to be serviced. There's a debt service here, and that means eventually they're going to have to raise tax considerably. And that's not even talking about Social Security and Medicare's deficits.
All right. You know, some of the figures you're throwing out, Bill, those are figures that's hard for the mind to wrap around those.
We're not used to trillion-dollar figure, Jan. You're right. Yeah. It used to be billions and hundreds of billions.
Billions.
But now, I remember in 1998, 1999, when long-term capital management had a credit derivatives default. It was $5.4 billion, and people were freaking out about $5.4 billion. The Fed came together. The powers to be came together. They worked out this problem, $5.4 billion. That's nothing.
Yeah, if some kid gets that for his allowance every week, probably. Now, here's another thing. I don't want to dwell on this AIG thing, but I just want to mention it here, because then get your response as well. Someone has written, you know, forget about the bonus outrage. This is concerning AIG. What about Sharia finance? AIG is Sharia compliant. That's Islamic law for a certain department within AIG. And as Frank Gaffney says, and boy, you know, Gaffney, when Gaffney speaks, people listen. This guy is tops on security.
Right on.
No matter what he talks about, he's the best. And he has written, Bill, give me your take on this. I'm very concerned. He says, will Obama embrace Sharia law as part of his respect Islam campaign. And then Gaffney says President Obama Friday reiterated for the umpteenth time his determination to develop a, quote, new relationship with the Muslim world. On this occasion, the audience were leaders of Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, and the Philippines. Well, they're probably explaining Sharia law is going to take a little bit too much time here, but go ahead and respond any way you'd care to with this issue I've just raised.
I completely concur about Frank Gaffney Jr. He was with the Reagan administration. He's Jewish. He's very pro-Israel, obviously. He's a bottom-line guy. Excuse me. And he's been talking about the threat of Iran for a long time. And it was interesting. He had an article, Goodbye Britain, that we've read.
Yeah.
And I think he said it was very this recent meeting of Gordon Brown, the UK Prime Minister, came to the White House, and it was just like a normal meeting. It wasn't like this is the British. President Bush was always so respectful of our long-term relationship with the British government and the British leaders. What Obama did in this meeting with Gordon Brown is give this statue back of Winston Churchill that was given to President Bush. You know, why not put it in one of our museums here or somewhere like that? No, he gave the statue back, which spoke volumes. Also, Gordon Brown brought a gift of previous editions of works and writings of Winston Churchill. And Obama gave him, in return, 25 DVDs of movies that weren't even in the, you know, you have a different a mechanism over there, so that they can't even be played on a British equipment. So it's 25 DVDs of some of our better movies. That was it. And Gaffney made a great point here. Is this a sign to Britain that this administration is going to travel another road?
Yeah.
In other words, travel a road to appease Islam and Russia and some of the enemies of America. And this longtime ally is basically being put aside. And even one of the State Department officials say, what's special about Britain? You know, I don't know why there's a big beef about it. Well, the British picked up on this big time, and this is very significant, Jan. I mean, come on. This is the fact that Churchill bust given back, the fact that those, I mean, what an insincere gift. I mean, basically somebody ran over to the local CVS store and grabbed some tapes or a tape store. And pick up the tapes. This was a very significant thing that Obama did, and I think it's something that's kind of ominous for us in the future. And we do know Sharia law, which is extreme fundamental Islamic law having to do with finances, has seeped into the UK and other countries, and it's very possible and plausible if he continues to attempt to appease Islam that this could possibly happen in America someday.
Well, it's in AIG. They have Sharia compliant banking within AIG. So that's why I raise the question. So I believe Gary Bauer has reported on that and a few others. And apparently, We the People own 80% of AIG, but We the People now promote Sharia as well within AIG.
Well, Gaffney was the one that wrote about the Harvard University sponsored a conference at the U.S. Treasury Department in November that had to do with Sharia law having to do with finances. This was a one-day event at the U.S. Treasury, co-sponsored by Harvard and some Islamic financial leaders. So it is around and about us.
Yeah.
AIG being compliant would be an example of we want some of your bucks, and we'll do what we have to get them.
Bill, I go back to our conversation that we seem to be, as you stated, leaving some allies and cozying up to the enemy, be it Syria, be it Iran, some other places in the Middle East. We seem to be doing things entirely backwards as it comes to foreign policy. And I'll play a clip top of the hour of President Obama throwing a olive branch to Ahmadinejad in Iran, who turned it down, I believe, this morning. But nonetheless, this is the mindset going on. Perhaps this is the mindset of the secular humanist. I don't know, if we treat our enemies with love, they will eventually love us. That's not your worldview or mine. Our Bible says the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked.
Mm-hmm. Well, You know, the fact that the first interview that...
Yeah, Al Arabia.
Exactly. Had with was with a Middle Eastern news service based in Saudi Arabia. And he was very open and said that relationships are going to be different and that he was looking forward to a rapport in the future with members of Islam, that he'd lived in a Muslim country, actually said countries in the interview, but country, and that, you know, his father was a Muslim, but not a practicing Muslim. He didn't mention that, but it's that was obviously the case. And I think, you know, Charles Krauthammer, Frank Gaffney, and a few others, Jewish men, wrote articles saying, look, wait a second, you're sitting here apologizing for what America has done. Let's look at what they have done to us. Terror events, bombings of embassies, the Marine barracks there in Lebanon, the terror in Iraq, in other parts of the Middle East, Afghanistan and Pakistan. He said, wait a second, what are you doing here? This administration believes that they, especially this president, believes that he can meet with anybody and through a charm offense develop a close relationship with them and for the positiveness of our country. But I think it's it doesn't bode well. And obviously, it's also a disconnect with the reality of this radical ideology called Islam. And I think it's, you know, you don't put off long-term relationships that, especially with nations that have stood with us through thick and thin and through difficult times for the sake of appeasing an enemy of America.
Well, it's just that the enemy doesn't even appreciate appeasement. They see that as weakness.
That's correct.
They're really, you know, they turned down his olive branch. I can play that clip, second hour of the president going to Iran, via video and saying, you know, let's be friends. If you'll tone down your rhetoric, I think we can be friends. That's a pretty simple paraphrase of what was said. Very, very troubling. I find that one of the most troubling things I've heard in the last 6-7 weeks. But nonetheless, that seems to be the position also, you know, of those on the left that are behind him. So there's just an awful lot of grand delusion going on. We need to get to some other issues, including, as we speak, taxpayers are rebuilding Hamas's killing machine. We've got again, and I'm backing up a little bit here because we've got overtures to what's called the moderate Taliban. Okay, I didn't know they existed, but you know, maybe I missed it somewhere.
I got a couple of political spin.
Caroline Glick writes how Hamas became kosher. These are just some other issues, and just a whole lot of other things. And you indicate, too, that you feel that Hillary Clinton has been marginalized in her role as she bounces around the world and how she kind of tried to take back center stage here in the last few weeks. I have about a minute left. Can you summarize that issue with Hillary?
It's been very interesting. As we watch, the National Security Advisor is publicly said he's going to have more and more responsibilities. That's General Jones there, and he works right there in the White House about 30, 40 feet from the Oval Office. That's very significant. Matter of fact, some of the responsibilities that typically would be at the State Department, he is taking over for himself at the White House under Obama's approval. I think that's pretty significant. Dick Morris felt that due to a couple members of Obama administration don't particularly care for Hillary Clinton, more and more responsibility will be taken from the State Department. But all that surfaced about a week before Hillary went to the Middle East and then Russia, then Turkey, and also meet with NATO members. And, boy, she was front stage for about 7 or 8 days. So she's going to fight back.
Bill, before we kind of move on out of the borders of the United States, and we perhaps will come back to them, we have not yet talked about the Federal Reserve, and I'm just holding that out for a second so that we are sure that we hit a couple of other points in other parts of the world. We can come back to the Federal Reserve a little bit later. But I don't want this issue I'm going to bring up to get away. I think you feel strongly, as do most Christians feel strongly, that what is happening in America today is probably some very, very severe judgment by God. Would that be true?
That's correct.
Is that, it's hardly a surprise, hardly a surprise.
No, no, exactly, Jan. I think when you look at, you know, sin has consequences, whether
yes.
it's immediate, midterm, or long-term. As we talked about in the previous hour, the United States has been blessed for many, many reasons because of our faith, because we have a lot of Christians in our country, the fact we've been a friend of Israel, and we've been blessed for a very, very long period of time. As one of my dear friends says, unfortunately, the world has invaded the church,
mm-hmm.
and today we're not the salt and light that God intends for us to be. And unfortunately, a lot of members of the church do not have a problem voting for someone that's moral agenda is completely contrary and in opposition to the scriptures. And throughout history, throughout biblical history, throughout recent history, is the leaders are usually a reflection of the
yes,
nation
yes.
That elects them. And my concern now is this administration is, what are they going to do with Israel? What are they going to do with the abortion agenda? At this point, it looks like they're going to do everything they can to wipe out any restriction to abortion, even fund international abortions, which they've already approved. And also their position on the stem cell, Obama's position on stem cell. And also, as I mentioned, you go to whitehouse.gov, that's the White House website, under the agenda, it's a tab at the top, look at civil rights, and you will see the LGBT agenda of the Obama administration, which means lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender agenda of this administration. And this administration is going to cross the line on three extremely significant areas that throughout recent history and even past history, God responds in a ferocity when these things are touched, or when we have administration that opposes the scriptures. And I think that's what we're headed towards.
All right. Let's move a little bit out of the U.S. And as I said, we may come back to it because there are other issues, but I want to get to this issue of the fact that American taxpayers now are, as we speak, rebuilding the Hamas killing machine. And it's pretty troubling to see the image of basically these Islamo-fascists in the Middle East literally doing, you know, the Nazi salute and all sorts of Western leaders bowing down before some of these guys, particularly Hamas, but others as well. And right now, as we speak, America is about to pump in almost about $1 billion into that part of the world to rebuild Hamas, actually, to rebuild the Gaza Strip. And, you know, you and I have no issues whatsoever with some of these civilians over there getting some humanitarian help and perhaps getting some of their homes reconstructed and all. But you and I know, obviously, most of this money doesn't get to them.
No, it doesn't. We've spent a couple $100 million on weapons for Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah, and they got into a civil war with Hamas, and Hamas basically took the weapons from Fatah. So our American taxpayer dollar weapons are in the hands of Hamas. What happened, too, is there were a war between Israel and Hezbollah and a war with Israel and Hamas and the international community, who just recently committed over $4.5 billion to rebuilding Gaza. Also provided billions of dollars there in southern Lebanon and southern Beirut to basically rebuild that part of that country. We have spent so much money in the Middle East and in Israel, around Israel, trying to push a deal, a peace deal. You know, practically and realistically, we know it's ridiculous and it's a waste of money, but biblically, we know these things are going to happen, which will eventually lead to a peace deal prior to Yeshua, Jesus Christ's return to Jerusalem. So from that perspective, we can deal with it. But from a practicality standpoint, it makes no sense. And, you know, we say we don't want to work with Hamas. The international community says that. But we continue to prop them up through aid and funds and trying to make them do peace with Israel when it's just not practical.
Heidi, I think you had an email there from Australia.
Yeah, this is pretty fun. Nicole from Australia is streaming, so that answers that question. She says she usually podcasts, but she's listening at 1 a.m. on Sunday in Austria. And her question for
That's
Bill.
Loyalty.
Her question for Bill is, how do you see the relationship between the U.S. and Australia from a political view?
Well, matter of fact, the Prime Minister of Australia is going to be at the White House on Tuesday. President Bush had a really good relationship with Australia. Australia was one of the two a couple countries that stood with us with some troops in Iraq. Mm-hmm. President Bush had a great appreciation for Israel, both the previous Prime Minister and Kevin Rudd. So I think it's always been a special relationship. Hopefully, and it will continue to be one. And I think that Australia has their own challenges dealing with a certain element of radical Islam within Australia. But I think we have a lot of things in common, and I think that relationship will continue to be maintained. We'll know a lot next week after Obama meets with the Prime Minister from Australia.
Now, Noni Darwish, and you met Noni at Understanding the Times 08, as she was one of our speakers, as were you. And she makes an interesting statement here. Of course, Noni was brought up over in the part of the world we're kind of dealing with right now. And Noni says in an article that she's written, probably for Horowitz Front Page magazine, I'm not sure, I think that's where it is, that international donors have pledged almost $4.5 billion in aid for Gaza earlier this month. And, of course, this is where Noni, she lived in Gaza in the 1950s. Again, America pledging up to $900 million. And, you know, I mean, she says for 60 years, and she's so right here, for 60 years, Palestinians have been used and abused by Arab regimes and Palestinian terrorists in their fight against Israel. Now it's Hamas, an Islamist terror organization supported by Iran, which is using and abusing Palestinians for this purpose. But I got to throw this in, Bill, because I think people hear the term, you know, Hamas and all of them, Hezbollah, you name it, Islamic Jihad. You know, we had Hamas demonstrating on the steps of the Minnesota State Capitol a couple of months ago. People don't realize, Americans don't realize that they are in America and they're here to cause trouble. They were demonstrating on the steps of the Capitol. This is not just a Middle East problem. This is an American problem.
You know, there's two agendas right now, Jan, that are extremely aggressive, confrontational, and combative, and that is Islam and the gay agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And they create a lot of disruption. They're intense.
Yes.
And most people will not stand up against them or will fight them. People want to go about their lives and not deal with it. I completely respect that. But at the same time, both these groups and movements and agendas know that. And so they are going to continue to push and push and push. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in here, in America. And we're going to attempt to try to make peace with them. That's why you're seeing some of the ecumenical events around the world between Christians, most of them from replacement theology churches, Jews, and Muslims, coming together for the sake of unity and peace. Matter of fact, they had an event in Yale last fall that you had Muslims, Christians, and Jews at, but before the meeting started, the Muslims required the Jews and Christians to sign off on the fact that Allah was the same God as the God of the Jews and Christians. And, you know, this whole ecumenical thing is an attempt to appease Islam, and, you know, Noni Darwish nails it every time. She says it's not a religion, it's an ideology.
Yes.
And she tells it like it is. And I think, Jan and Heidi, this is a situation that we're dealing with. It won't change. They'll keep pushing. People get tired of them pushing. And then they do whatever they can to make these people happy. And that only ends up being worse in the long run.
Obama's attempt to reach out to Iran this week. And he actually, it was recorded. It was on WhiteHouse.gov, but for that matter, it was almost everywhere. And basically saying, you know, if you'll tone down the rhetoric, the president said, we want to throw you an olive branch. Why don't we just hear what he has to say?
Today, I want to extend my very best wishes to all who are celebrating Nowruz around the world. This holiday is both an ancient ritual and a moment of renewal, and I hope that you enjoy this special time of year with friends and family. In particular, I would like to speak directly to the people and leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Nowruz is just one part of your great and celebrated culture. Over many centuries, your art, your music, literature, and innovation have made the world a better and more beautiful place. Here in the United States, our own communities have been enhanced by the contributions of Iranian Americans. We know that you are a great civilization, and your accomplishments have earned the respect of the United States and the world. For nearly three decades, relations between our nations have been strained. But at this holiday, we are reminded of the common humanity that binds us together. Indeed, you will be celebrating your New Year in much the same way that we Americans mark our holidays, by gathering with friends and family, exchanging gifts and stories, and looking to the future with a renewed sense of hope. Within these celebrations lies the promise of a new day, the promise of opportunity for our children, security for our families, progress for our communities, and peace between nations. Those are shared hopes. Those are common dreams. So in this season of new beginnings, I would like to speak clearly to Iran's leaders. We have serious differences that have grown over time. My administration is now committed to diplomacy that addresses the full range of issues before us and to pursuing constructive ties among the United States, Iran, and the international community. This process will not be advanced by threats. We seek instead engagement that is honest and grounded in mutual respect. You too have a choice. The United States wants the Islamic Republic of Iran to take its rightful place in the community of nations. You have that right, but it comes with real responsibilities. And that place cannot be reached through terror or arms, but rather through peaceful actions that demonstrate the true greatness of the Iranian people and civilization. And the measure of that greatness is not the capacity to destroy. It is your demonstrated ability to build and create. So on the occasion of your New Year, I want you, the people and leaders of Iran, to understand the future that we seek. It's a future with renewed exchanges among our people and greater opportunities for partnership and commerce. It's a future where the old divisions are overcome, where you and all of your neighbors and the wider world can live in greater security and greater peace. I know that this won't be reached easily. There are those who insist that we be defined by our differences. But let us remember the words that were written by the poet Sa'di so many years ago. The children of Adam are limbs to each other, having been created of one essence. With the coming of a new season, we're reminded of this precious humanity that we all share. And we can once again call upon this spirit as we seek the promise of a new beginning. Thank you. And Eid Shoma Mubarak.
Bill Koenig, we do not share common hopes and common dreams. What are your thoughts when you hear this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's an attempt to bring the world together in the name of peace. And what was interesting, Jan, is Ayatollah Khomeini, Iran's supreme leader, dismissed the overtures of Obama, saying that Tehran does not see any change in American policy towards its government. And this is very interesting here. He told tens of thousands of people in the holy city of Mashhad how Khomeini asked, how could he congratulate Iranians on the new year while the U.S. continues to accuse the country of supporting terrorism and seeking nuclear weapons? I mean, right there, it gives you a total disconnect.
Disconnect.
You know, how could he say that when, in fact, they are, you know? And you can't make peace with these radical people. 15% of Iran is radical. 85% is not.
That's right.
I have some good Iranian friends that work at the White House. They're very nice people. We have friends here in Washington that are Iranian that are not part of that 15%. But unfortunately, this, as you know, this 15% Khomeini's bunch controls the country. And until that grip is loosened, you won't see any change. And unfortunately, we probably won't see a change until they become nuclear and there will be subsequent consequences.
Yeah, consequences. Go ahead, Heidi.
You know, I have to say that as an American citizen, not to mention a single adult woman, that this kind of rhetoric makes me feel so insecure. But just as an American citizen, so he's reaching out to our enemies and wishing them well and slapping our allies in the face with DVDs.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And, you know, again, it gives you an example of the true power that Islam does have. They have a tremendous amount of oil. They have, you know, Iran's been a big problem for us with Hamas and Hezbollah. They do not want to see the situation in Afghanistan get any better, despite the fact a lot of their young people are being affected by the poppies and the heroin growth that's being produced out of Afghanistan. They want the disruption. Iran is a problematic. They want a caliphate all the way from Iran to Lebanon, and they have their own agenda. And it's a and plus Ahmadinejad believes he has been called to usher in the Muslim Messiah, the 12th Imam.
That is the wild card people forget about. That's what makes this a serious issue, not just rhetoric.
Absolutely.
And he is here
Absolutely.
On assignment, this guy, Ahmadinejad, is here on assignment. And that's what all of these people, that's the equation they are leaving out, is the Mahdi.
Absolutely, Jan. As a matter of fact, one of Vice President Cheney's associates, one of his top staff members, says people forget the fact mm-hmm. that this is a apocalyptic, even a messianic complex that this Ahmadinejad has, and that's what we're dealing with. And because we're dealing with that, nothing else matters.
Okay. Also, we're apparently going to reach out to the moderate Taliban. Okay. I'm missing something, I can tell. I think the inmates are running the asylum these days. U.S. courts, former warlords, in its bid for Afghan stability, please wake up and smell the bagels in Washington, would you? There are no moderate Taliban. Here, let's see. The genocidal jihadist terrorist group, this is Hamas, is but a step away from an invitation to the Oval Office. Two events in the past week show this to be the case. And that would be first last Saturday, Paul Volcker, who serves as U.S. President Barack Obama's economic recovery advisor, and several former senior U.S. officials have written a letter to the president calling for the U.S. to recognize Hamas as one of the signatories. Brent Scowcroft, former national security advisor under George Herbert Walker Bush, explained, "I see no reason not to talk to Hamas." Bill, we've beaten this to death, but nonetheless, again, this is delusion run amok here. When we've got some fairly seasoned politicians saying, "I see no reason not to talk to Hamas and invite them into the Oval Office."
What's going on here right now is a couple things. When there was a gap between the election and inauguration, the European Union became very involved in talks and also negotiations on the Israeli-Hamas conflict there in Gaza, as well as helping head up the push for international donor dollars to help rebuild Gaza. They also have continued over the last year or two to float this trial balloon about the fact that, you know, we really should talk to these people since they control the Palestinian Authority, and we really do need to sit down and try to work something out with them. Then Tony Blair, the chief envoy for the quartet, stated, he would be in favor of talking with Hamas if, one, Hamas acknowledged Israel's right to exist, if they would put down the weapons mm-hmm. and stop the rockets, then he
not.
Would favor talking to Hamas, which are conditions they can't meet.
Right.
And then what's interesting right now is we have seven previous administrations, which is unprecedented, advising this administration on how they should handle Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Let's just get some of the names from these previous administrations. I mean, there's Zbigniew Brzezinski, there's Henry Kissinger, Brent Scowcroft. Just give us a few other names.
Tony Lake, Sandy Berger. We've got Dennis Ross.
Mm-hmm.
We have, Madeleine Albright, Condoleezza Rice to a certain extent, previous secretaries of state, previous national security mm-hmm. advisors, and previous advisors like Dennis Ross. People have actually been involved in negotiations. Most of these people have all been committed. Even James Baker and Lee Hamilton. And also Jimmy Carter.
Yeah. How could we forget him?
Well, yeah.
He won't let us forget him.
That's why we have forgotten him. But he was in the White House a week ago, and he has been so determined on seeing a solution here. But I think the principals right now have been recently have been Scowcroft and Zabrinsky. They wrote a book together, and also Jimmy Carter that has been all in favor of talking with Hamas all along. But they are all advising this administration to push forward and quick and get this thing worked out. That's the influence on this administration. So far, they've been pragmatic. So far, they have had other issues they've had to deal with. At some point in time, they will probably go forward. George Mitchell's already been there twice, and Hillary Clinton was just there. So I think we'll start seeing some more activity after the Netanyahu government's put in place.
Yeah, and we need to talk about that right now. We need to take a couple of emails that have come in. Heidi, you go ahead and pick what the best ones are.
Well, a couple of them are related. Bob from New Brighton says, do you think that most Americans realize what is happening to their country, and do they intend to do something about it in the next election to preserve their country? The people hold the power of the vote in this country, but when the mainstream media is so biased and slants the truth in favor of liberalism, the people are deceived.
Now why don't we stop there and let Bill respond to that?
Okay.
The next one plays into it?
Exactly.
Go ahead.
In Maple Grove, in light of the current political situation, Bible prophecy, and God's judgment on America, what are Christians going to do, or what are the Christians to do to help bring America back to God? Is it too late to be involved in the political process? So they're both along the same lines, Bill.
They're very good questions, and really, in a lot of ways, they're fairly complex answers.
And we have about 3 minutes.
Okay. Thanks for that. Yeah,
I know.
Appreciate that. I think a couple things here is, number one, it was still a close race between Obama and McCain. Number two, I don't really see any Republican right now really being the standard bearer for the party. That's problematic. Number three, America is not happy, Democrats and Republicans. Number four, a lot of Americans are so busy just trying to make ends meet don't have a full comprehension of the depth of what's going on here in Washington, D.C. We try to stay up to date with that with our weekly news report, WorldNet Daily, Fox News. But the media is so far to the left that there's a lot of things that are extremely alarming to us as Christians that we would do more about if we knew about it. I think that's a big factor. The other thing is, when you really look at it, the Christians from the more moderate part of the church helped elect Barack Obama. Also, there was an article by George Barna's research group a couple weeks ago, is between 18 and 25 year of age young adults in America, only 1% of them have a biblical worldview, and a majority of them voted for Obama.
They're probably in the emergent church.
Yeah, absolutely. And so consequently, we have to be hold our leaders more accountable to our moral values. The fact Obama was elected is an indication on the moral condition of our country. So with that said, is we have to continue to pray for leadership that will follow biblical principles that we adhere to. And I know the Lord has some plans in all of this, and hopefully more and more people will come to know Christ as their Lord and Savior through these times.
Yes. Yeah. So often what Satan means for evil, God will use for good. And I think that we have to focus on the fact that hard times often do bring some people back to their senses, but much more importantly, bring some people back to God, or to God for the first time in their life, because they've run out of all other resources. We had a conversation a while ago about the Fairness Doctrine, and you feel quite strongly that it will not happen.
I believe that the Obama administration does not want that fight. They even said something a couple of weeks ago. The press secretary said that they do not favor a change, and they do not favor the Fairness Doctrine. There might be some people like Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and a few people in Congress that might attempt to push it, but he specifically said that he would not favor it. So unless there's a change, that's pretty much the way it's going to go. I think it would be an enormous fight. I think it would be very, very divisive, and I think hopefully also cooler head will will prevail and won't even get to that point. So I feel good at this point, Jan, at least for this year.
All right. You know, it would go to the Supreme Court and be a terrible mess. But,
long. It would take it'd be a long time. I don't think it's the Republican, actually put it this way, the conservative radio shows are successful. Very successful.
Yes, they are.
And the ones, the liberal talk programs do not do very well. Even their big network, Air America, is in bankruptcy. So it's just to be a big mistake all the way around.
Bill, I've heard rumor and read rumor that it wouldn't be called the Fairness Doctrine, that President Obama would actually bring it in stealth.
Yeah, through the back door, maybe.
Well, at this point, Heidi, I think he's got other more significant issues to face. This one would be very divisive, and I think these guys are fairly shrewd. I mean, not fairly shrewd. They're shrewd, and it's just not a fight they want to participate in now.
All right, let's see here. All right, here's what I want to do, Bill. Let's real quickly, and I know that's a little bit unfair to everybody, but let's just recap the scenario found in Ezekiel 38 and 39 and why that is so important that we're even bringing it up. It's known in the Bible. It was written 2,600 years ago as Gog and Magog, and theologians, at least theologians you and I agree with, Bill, maybe they're becoming fewer and fewer all the time, but they would tell us that Gog is likely the head of Magog, which is Russia, and that Russia will bring together a number of Islamic entities together in a last days war. They'll swoop down into Israel to seize a spoil. Now, that there would be hooks put in the jaws, particularly of Russia, to bring her down with these Islamic entities accompanying her. And many have wondered for quite a while what on earth, what kind of hook could be put in the jaw of Russia to cause her to do this heinous act, which we don't know the timing. You know, it could be tomorrow, it could be 10 years from now, 20 years, we don't know. We just don't know. However, here's the point I'm leading to, and let me get your take on it. Obviously, some know that there was an absolutely gigantic find of natural gas right off the coast of Israel, 5 trillion cubic feet of natural gas that's come out in the last 3-4 months. This should be major news. It's kind of buried news. It should be major. You told me the other day, Bill Koenig, that you think that perhaps ancient gold may also be discovered in Israel, making the world envious. And you take it from there where you see this could possibly be heading.
Well, ancient gold has been a theory that some people have believed would be part of the motivation for the force from the north to come against Israel, which is very interesting and very plausible because there was a tremendous amount of gold way back when. This 5 trillion cubic feet of gas is one of the largest natural gas finds in America, or not in America, but throughout the world this year and over the last couple of years. It's just absolutely enormous. And I talked to a friend a couple of days ago in Phoenix that has a friend that was involved in that, and he said that they believe there's more than even that. So I think there's a potential fight brewing over that between Lebanon and the Israelis and even Cyprus, but I think that'll work out to Israel's advantage. Also, some people still believe that there's crude oil, actual oil,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Underneath the Dead Sea, and they would siphon off some of the very rich oil from Saudi Arabia. And also, there's a possibility of some oil north in northern Samaria. These are all possibilities. Also, the technology. Israel has some of the great scientific and computer technology people in the world, and no telling what that could mean in terms of value in the future. I believe, as far as the hook, Jan, I believe the hook has been placed. I've been watching Russia do things in the last 12 to 18 months that are extremely problematic. They right now are putting together some former Soviet Union countries up near the Caucasian Mountains in a military force to eventually be able to defend itself against the NATO force in that area of the world. That's very significant. Russia right now is developing a port on the Mediterranean in Tartus, Syria, which would be fairly close to this natural gas find. Also, they're going to be developing a port in Libya, which is part of the Gog-Magog force.
That's right.
And also in Yemen. That's very significant. They are selling more weapons to the Middle Eastern countries, also to Iran and Syria. They are also calling to sponsor a peace conference this year between the Palestinians and the Israelis, but they want to include Syria, too. And that is something they want to hold in Moscow this year. Lavrov, the foreign minister, was down in Israel a couple months ago to say we're ready to do it. They want a stronger role in the peace process, as well as a continued stronger role in the Middle East.
Well, Bill, you said the other day, you know, Russia is furious with us for supposedly causing this financial meltdown, which is global, which has affected them something terrible. You even suggested that Russia might have thoughts of retaliating against America. How would you see that playing out?
That's an extreme example, Jan, but at the same time, when Russia's meeting with Cuban officials, when we're talking about the president of Russia, Medvedev, having gone to Cuba last fall and also going to Venezuela to meet with Chavez, in the last couple of weeks, both Cuba and Venezuela have made military facilities available to Russian bombers. The fact that Russia is not happy about our potential missile defense system in their proximity, and also the fact that Putin is furious, the fact that their stock market's lost over 72% of its market capitalization, and blames us for the world economic crisis, you know, how would they retaliate? Well, military would be one way, and not only over there, but possibly even here. I don't know what would actually make the big bear mad, Jan, but I know they aren't happy with us right now. And just some of these things they've done in Cuba and Venezuela are somewhat problematic.
Right. We have Prime Minister soon-to-be Benjamin Netanyahu coming into office within Israel. Now, I think he might have the strength and the courage to go against Iran?
He has been so outspoken.
Yes, he has.
About the risks that Israel faces with Iran. He has said that we have to plan to go about it ourselves. He said that for over the last 2 years in America and around the world. He and Ehud Barak are developing a closer and closer relationship. They do see eye to eye on the situation, the threats of Iran. Moshe Ayalon, former director of the IDF, is also very concerned about Iran. He's been very articulate and outspoken about it. He's a no BS kind of guy. He tells it like it is. Also, Dori Gold, who's one of former Israeli ambassador to the UN, is one of Netanyahu's key advisors. And we had a meeting with Gold in October, and he was talking about the great concern and threat of Iran. And he said that by the end of this year, early next year, something is going to have to be done with the Iranian threat. At this point, with the new administration here in Washington, they're going to try the diplomatic route, but I don't see it working. And obviously, at some point, Netanyahu's going to have to be the one that pulls the trigger, because it's a very serious threat to a very tiny, small Middle Eastern country, and Israel's got to do something.
Well, do you have any kind of in your mind, any kind of a timetable? Are we thinking a year from now or perhaps?
Well, I thought what Dori Gold said to us personally in October, and I heard him on the 700 Club in September say the same thing, that Gold really felt, and he's a straight-shooting guy, that something has to be done this year, early next year, Jan. Unless,
that's what I thought, too.
Iran slows down. So I don't know what that means at this point, but they're getting to the point of no return if they haven't already crossed
exactly.
it. So eventually something's going to have to be done.
Yeah, but you know what's going to happen. I mean, if they do this, and of course there are multiple reactors that they would have to take out, unlike in 1981 in Iraq, they took out just the one, and the world scorned them for having taken out one of those reactors in Iraq. If she takes out the reactors in Iran, one or more, or 10 or 20, I think there are dozens of them, the world again will chastise her and demonize her for doing the world a favor.
Well, what's interesting about that, Jan, a couple things. One is I'm hearing more and more diplomatic people are starting to say, well, what is the risk of having Iran go have nuclear weapons? They're beginning to almost talk themselves out of concern about
mm-hmm.
risk.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the more moderates say, well, big deal. So they have it. You know, they're only going to have a small amount, and they'd be crazy to use it because if they did use it, it would be very costly. But, again, we know Iran has their eyes in Israel, so that's very significant. The other thing, too, is, like you said, this is a complicated situation. These things are buried. No one knows where they are exactly.
Yeah, they're underground.
Are the level of advancement that they have achieved at this point in time. So that's very risky. The other thing is I've talked to some of the moderates from Iran
mm-hmm.
who really do not like the government in place, but they told me that the 85% would come alongside the 15% if the U.S. or Israel attacked Iran. So you see the problems of the attack, too, with the rest of the Iranian people. They're considered moderate people.
Okay, let's real quickly hit on one more trouble spot as we're trying to go around the world in 120 minutes. And that is, we haven't made real good progress, but we're trying to do the best we can. Because it's a big world out there. The powder keg within Afghanistan / Pakistan. We've got Pakistan, who's almost becoming an al-Qaeda enclave, and they've got nuclear weapons by the gazillion. And how do you see this playing out, particularly under the Obama administration here, with particularly the administration's soft take on anything Islamic?
Well, there's a lot of discussion right now. What's the best way to handle it? John McCain and a few of the members of the Senate believe send more troops in. Let's beef this up. Let's get aggressive. Let's win this war. But what's interesting, a guy by the name of David Kilcullen, who advised Petraeus, he's an Australian counterinsurgency expert, says that there's really a four-stage model that you have to acknowledge in these situations. He said, first of all, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, they will infect an area. And then eventually they will start creating some problems to the point they will mount attacks which will provoke an American response. And then when the Americans respond, then people that aren't necessarily anti-American become anti-American, and then you've got your war started. And this is a modus operandi that was in Iraq. And this is he says you have to be very careful. He says at this point you have to take care of your centralized or your centralized problems. Don't bring too many troops in to provoke it, manage it. But he says you also have the risk if you leave, then you've been defeated. So you have to be very wise how you handle these. And he also says you need to develop some relationships with some of the factions in these areas, which Petraeus was able to do so effectively. They use special forces and develop relations with the tribal people in these areas, and that's one of the reasons they were so effective.
Okay, but I want to get to Pakistan here, because Pakistan is powder keg.
Well, Pakistan's a big problem. See, what happened is Musharraf, when he was, you know, we gave him billions of
mm-hmm.
dollars. But see, Musharraf was a military guy. Musharraf basically played two ends. One, he had a good relationship with the Bush administration. At the other end, he had a workable relationship with the terrorist organizations. He never actually opposed them. They kind of coexisted. But Rice and Bush wanted democracy. They made Musharraf allow Bhutto to come in. She was assassinated. Musharraf's out of power. Bhutto's husband's in power. He's not trusted. So it's very problematic, and the great concern right now is the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are gaining much, much more strength up in the northern part of Pakistan where the 70 nuclear weapons are, and it is a mess.
Yeah.
You'll see one day good news, next day bad news. Next day good news, next day bad news. very problematic, Jan. I don't think anybody really knows how to handle it.
Well, my question is, and we don't know, I guess, and that would be how the current administration, the Obama administration, is going to be dealing with Pakistan, because it is such a powder keg with nuclear weapons proliferating within Pakistan. Bill, in a few minutes, we need to sum up what we've been talking about with some positive news, some good news, because if listeners don't focus on the blessed hope, on the peace that passes all understanding that our Lord Jesus gives us, they can walk away from 120 minutes around the world and say, stop the world, I want to get off, let me take a spaceship to the next planet. We got to give them a little bit more hope.
No, absolutely, Jen. And I think sometimes I watch this news day in, day out, and I watch it with great interest and great fascination. A lot of that has to do with the fact that I know the way these things are going to play out.
Mm-hmm.
I know the scriptures that were written over 2,000 to 2,500 years ago are playing out in our time, which we're very, very blessed to have. I mean, it's so exciting. So it's exciting to see the Lord work in our lives, but it's also exciting to watch Bible prophecy play out the way that it is supposed to play out. And the bottom line in all of this is Israel is at the center of God's redemptive plan for not only that nation, but for the nations of the world. So through these times and through these challenging moments, many people, Jews and Muslims and atheists, agnostics, Hindus and Buddhists, are going to come to know that Jesus Christ is their Lord and Savior. And that's the blessed hope.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what these times are moving towards, Jan. And we have much to be thankful for. And we're also should be thanking the Lord every day that we have a full biblical understanding from Genesis to Revelation of the significance of these times.